Like to start, this is what I want to talk about, not about reconnection particularly directly, but about the structures in which we think the reconnection happens, in active regions in particular. But to get you accustomed to my voice, first I'll start with a digression. This is a book I read on Sunday, very nice little book called The Golem. You can buy it or sit in the shop and just read it at the Cambridge University Press. It has 7 chapters which describe controversial epochs in the history of science. It's written by science historians, so it puts a particular kind of spin on the kinds of things they talk about. They're interested in, for instance, the question of how you compare theory and observation. So I'm an experimental physicist by training. Maybe Len Culhane is the only other one in the room. And we're accustomed to doing an experiment, putting error bars on this measurement of a specific parameter, and then comparing that with a theory. But to make the comparison of the theory is also quite indirect, because some person has to interpret the theory and get the corresponding number out of the theory with an expectation that people will believe that prediction, that the prediction actually flows from the theory. And the particular example in this book, which is kind of relevant here, is the one by Eddington's observation of the deflection of starlight by the sun in 1919, in which he got the right answer. But apparently, according to this book, it was more a case of wishful thinking than it was actual result. Nevertheless, the consensus changed then in the correct direction, and we now believe Einstein completely. But that moment in history was not necessarily more than just kind of a milestone in the development of the comparison between theory and observation. All right, so that's just waffling on. Now you can understand what I'm saying. I'll proceed. What I want to do is talk about what an active region looks like to an observer, magnetic structure in general, waves, oscillations, and restructuring, and then some comments about what Ressi sees if there's time. This is a solar active region as seen by TRACE at very high resolution. You can see those fine filamentary structures. Many, many active regions look like this. Nice things about this are that those structures, we believe, really define the geometry of the field wherever the structures are bright. But a cautionary note is that, I think Bernhard was emphasizing this point, these structures are showing us only a very small part of the plasma, just that part of the plasma that happens to be within the passband of the instrument, whose dynamic range can see it. And I think you can see in the background of the loops here, the moss. There's moss in there. This moss is the foot points of higher temperature loops that are invisible in this trace image. We know that by comparison with SXT soft X-ray observations. And so the whole volume of the active region is filled with magnetic field, and we're seeing tracers of it in these emitting zones. So what are the mechanical properties of this kind of a structure? And I should point out that this structure is stable, right? What I often hear is that the corona is constantly moving. It's a dynamic sort of thing. That's sort of true on small scales, but not on large scales. On large scales, the characteristic of the corona is that it stays put in between events. The events are these huge eruptions that are called flares, and they're very clear in the time series. The time series is constant of soft X-rays, let's say, and then bang, a flare happens. So it's a stable structure. We think that these flares and the CMEs, which are the eruptions associated with them, are magnetically driven. That's sort of the consensus from energy that's stored in the corona. And in such conditions, it's low plasma beta. The mechanical stresses of the structure are entirely a pressure and a tension force in the stress tensor. And as the dissipation, as I pointed out, is slow, we have to accumulate energy in this structure and then let it go rapidly. And I'm not sure this is really relevant to any particular aspect of the theory, but I'd point this out. I think it's different from the case of the magnetosphere. This is an electrical equipotential before the event happens, except for this Rosslyn-Panikkok potential. This is about a kilovolt. Right, now this is a very nice paper of Alan Gary, one of the illustrations from it that summarizes the observations. There are several graphs like this. I'm just showing you the one that shows plasma beta in an active region. And this gray zone is the sort of the allowed domain. It's a logarithmic scale in height. So zero or unity here is the reference point. The photosphere is down here. I guess the reference point is the Tau 5000, the normal reference point. Here's the corona here. And you can see that systematically beta is low. And I put a point on here for a coronal hole. So both inside and outside the active region, one basically has low beta in the corona. And you can think of, therefore you can think of the corona as kind of a concentric capacitor. There's a photosphere at the bottom. There's a solar wind at the top, where the beta can be different. But in this zone, this concentric zone, it's basically just magnetic. And I had mentioned that there are a couple of other, this is a consensus that this is how it works, but there are a couple of theorists of the flare and CME physics that who think a little bit differently about this. One is B.C. Lowe, and one is Jim Chen from NRL. And so it's not totally accepted that this is how it really works. So what are the loops that we see in those trace images, for example? They show us the direction of the magnetic field at higher energies in soft X-rays, where Yoko observed. It's known that the visibility of the corona is a monotonically increasing function of the gas pressure, right? And so really, it's a broadband kind of measurement, and the brighter it is, the higher the pressure, the gas pressure. Of course, that's not the magnetic pressure, and assumption is that it's low beta, and so this gas pressure is actually kind of irrelevant to the mechanical behavior of the structure. Just a tracer. As has been pointed out, the loop dimensions that we see are typically smaller than the scale height in active regions. And the way it works, I think, is that a given loop with a given gas pressure on it digs a hole in the transition region until it gets to the appropriate pressure. There's a little gouge taken out of the chromosphere. You can see a cartoon of that in Hirayama's 1974 cartoon. Don't have a view of it. And in the loops, if one has a magnetostatic equilibrium determined by the magnetic field, the presence of gas pressure probably means that the loop itself that you see is kind of a little tunnel that's going through the medium. The magnetic field is a little bit weaker. So this is a picture of a simulation by a graduate student in Berkeley, Lorraine Lundquist, of an active region as observed by SXT. This is actual X-ray observations. Here she has actually filled a reconstructed magnetic field with gas according to a certain prescription relating the density to the magnetic field. And this is kind of a mechanical model of an active region. Why is that interesting? Let's take another look at something like that. This is a mechanical model of an active region. This is just the magnetogram with a reconstruction based upon the Remiliotis technique that Jim McTiernan has done. And this is a typical active region, 2.5 arc minute sort of scale. This is usually you see these reconstructions of the field represented as field lines. But here, what I've done is I've calculated the mean B and just plotted different layers of it. So this is the bottom. This is essentially the magnetogram. This is one step up. This is about the bottom of the corona. This is the photosphere. This is the bottom of the corona. This is two steps up, not very far, and this is five steps up. On this side, the magnetic field is shown with each frame scaled on its own independently. Here I've shown it with a uniform scaling, so that you can compare the field intensity B here, five steps up, with the field intensity in the photosphere. And you can see that it's almost invisible. And if I'd done the more correct thing, which is to make B squared here to represent energy more correctly, it would be totally invisible on this scaling. And so that, plus the fact that it simplifies very rapidly with height, leads me to a conjecture. I think that's here. Conjecture is that most of the free energy in an active region, which is to say the stress or the currents or the potential, non-potential behavior of the structure, is at its very bottom. Right? That's where we should be looking for physical mechanisms that make changes, not up there at the top of the corona where there's almost no non-potentiality. That's a debatable point. This is a very conjectural kind of statement. And as I said, the normal state of the corona in an active region is in equilibrium. And of course, if it is in equilibrium, it will oscillate if it's perturbed. We observe these oscillations now quite amazingly in several ways. The first way was the kink mode oscillations discovered by Shriver et al. From trace imaging, just an image series, a movie. I'll show you a movie if it works, and you can see that. We've now found actually that these are really closely associated with type 2 bursts. So here's a couple of examples. This is Marcus Ashwanden has provided these. I've stolen his figures. These are kind of radio spectrograms that show very faint here. You can see, just barely see the type 2 signatures. And in each case, what's happening is there's a flare, and then a couple of 100,000 kilometers away, there's an active region loop. The flare emits a wave. The wave runs out, resonates with this loop, which then oscillates. And the oscillation takes the form of a damped sinusoid. You can see typically several cycles and a rapid damping, which is still the subject of a lot of debate and discussion. Why does it damp so rapidly? This is not a dissipative system at all. It should ring forever. And this is just illustrating that point. A recent paper by Narukage et al. Showing that this dome, this green dome-like thing, is the shock wave going out from the flare, and its foot points can be seen in the H-alpha of the chromosphere. This is what's called a Morton wave. And then it goes out in the corona, and you can see it, in the best cases, in soft X-rays. And in fact, there are many other ways to see it. That's one kind of oscillation and its explanation. Another kind of oscillation is from Sumer, and I think Bernhard Klein was an author of the original discovery paper here. This is, if I have this right, here's the Sumer slit up here, and at point A here, something happens, and you can see this bright and dark pattern of velocity, right, coming and going. These loops are smaller than the loops that exhibited the kink modes, and they're interpreted as sausage modes. That's another one of the standard classifications of the oscillating coronal loops. There's a third kind of modality now that is back to the Yoko data that I've learned about a month or so ago from John Mariska. And this is from the BCS lens instrument. For flares that are just occulted by the limb, so you don't see the bright footpoints of the flare, but still on a very much smaller scale, you see a very similar kind of damped sinusoid in many, many examples. So these are, I'd like to emphasize that just in the last couple of years, we now have dozens of examples of three different modes of trapped oscillation. And of course, what this means to an experimentalist is the instrumented hammer. I'll get to that in a minute, but let me show you if this works. Let me show you the, how do I do it? Yeah. This is a nice movie showing an example of the, showing several things, actually. So I have a list of things you should look for in this movie. But at the very end, you'll see some oscillating loops. The second event's about to happen. There it goes. And you can see this rippling along here. It goes through again and again. Another thing you should see here is the dimming as the CME takes off from the previous event. These are the post-flare loops that are still there. Another event happens, and you can see this jiggling back and forth here. This is not just normal modes, but it's coupled normal modes. And so there's really a full eigenspectrum that one can get at, in principle, to learn more about the mechanical structure of this active region, I believe. Nobody has really done much with it yet, but in any case, this is, I think, an exciting idea for future development. So in that movie, you saw the dimming, excitation of the normal modes, and in the first frames, I didn't point this out, an arcade blowout, which I think is a fascinating phenomenon, and I had actually done one of the Yoko science nuggets on something we saw like this in SXT. So I'm just throwing this in for sheer vanity, but here's a post-flare loop system, a large arcade flare. And here's another one that happens. And in the difference image here, you see a dimming What that means is that the previous arcade has gone away, just like you saw in the previous movie from Trace with very much better resolution. How can this be? The flare happens, the field restructures itself until it's into the most robust configuration, the most potential-like structure. How can it then unstably go away? This just shows you, I think, how weak our understanding of the dynamics of these systems is. All right, so how do we study these equilibria? Now we get to the instrumented hammer idea. It would be nice if we could build models like Lundquist's model and use these things that we've got. We can use high resolution, precise observations, image observations and trace, and we can use things like, if we can get the radio telescope phaser to be built, we can use the gyroresonant surface, very precise measure of the magnetic field strength in an active region. Is quite feasible. Don't have illustrations of that. And then we can also use things like Solar B to do very good reconstructions, and other data from Solar B and from SDO to fit these models against. And then we can take these models and we can hit them. Right? One way to do that in spacecraft design, I think, is to get what is called an instrumented hammer. You tap the structure and you listen to it ring, and you measure through the miracle of Fourier transforms the locations of the resonances. This is very important for the design because the spacecraft can collapse if it's launched if you don't get these resonances just right. Another way to do it is to put the spacecraft on what's called a shake table and just shake it and just do all of the normal modes all simultaneously. And that's, of course, another way to do it. We did that with HESI before it was launched, and we broke it, of course. So maybe an instrumented hammer in the right hands is a good idea. Those are things that we can do now with active regions. Another thing that we can do, which I'm just announcing to you, perhaps you were, like I was, you were skeptical about this. It's been coming, though. We've been expecting it to happen. And there's a paper by Haimin Wang et al. A couple of years ago in which there were six examples of this given. This is the only really credible one. You can see up here measures of the magnetic field, magnetic flux, the line of sight flux. This is a vector measurement, but I think this is just line of sight flux. I'm not even sure exactly what this is, but the key thing is that the flux measurement is constant, then a flare happens, and then it's displaced. All right, so there's a before and after distinction in the photospheric magnetic field when a flare happens. And the reason this is worth mentioning now is that it's, I'm told, through a poster that Jack Harvey had at the Solar Physics Division meeting a couple of months ago in Denver, that every X-class flare does this. So now this is a reproducible observational tool that we've got. There are other examples, Zhakova and Kasabachev. This is what I'm announcing is that we're now free to think about this before and after distinction in the photospheric field. And the challenge from that is, can any existing model of the dynamics of a flare or CME actually describe this change before and after? What are the predictions? All right? And these are predictions that people should agree upon. This is not just a cartoon level sort of thing. We're ready now to really do engineering, I think, on these structures. Right, so I'm actually more or less finished. I just wanted to show a few cartoons. This is a cartoon. This is my cartoon from the Cartoon Archive. If you haven't seen the Cartoon Archive, this is a series of web pages that I keep that has, I think, a cartoon from almost everybody. But there are some experts in this room who are not represented, so all you have to do is point this out to me that you're not there. Is there a Kleem? I don't know if there's a Kleem. Is there a priest, even? I don't know if there's a priest. That would be terrible. Oh, there's a Cargill. There's a Cargill and priest. In any case, these are all the cartoons with references. And an example of it is this. This is the Unser and Newman cartoon from 1982, which is one of the very first in which there's really a kind of a 3D structural representation. And implicit in this are nulls and separatrices and things like that. That wasn't their language then. The language then was to call a coronal mass ejection a transient. But still, I think the basic geometry is there. Now, my cartoon, before I get to the conclusions, is just this. It only tries to illustrate one point, and that is that within this before and after evolution of the active region to make a flare or a CME, there's going to be a reduction of b squared over 8 pi, the integral of that over the volume. The energy has to go down. It has to go from one equilibrium state to another one at a lower energy if it's going to happen unstably. And so when that happens, line-tied field lines must shrink. This is what happens in the standard model in the late phase of a flare when the shrinkage or the dipolarization of the field, I think, just makes it smaller and it releases energy. But that's not explaining the impulsive phase. So we should see this kind of inward motion in the impulsive phase. And that's, I guess, really why I showed this movie. Try it again. Look at the beginning of this. This first event that happens. Watch the first. Is it going to work for me again? I haven't learned how to operate this movie properly. There it goes. You saw the very first few frames there. It'll come back again. Look for the shrinkage. Okay. Here are the oscillations coming, and now starts again. First frames show an inward motion. All right. Is this an example of what this cartoon predicts, or is it just wishful thinking by a cartoonist? I can't answer that. So my conclusions are, unlike the cartoon, the cosmology, we don't really have a standard model for flares and CMEs. We really can't make this comparison in mutually agreed upon neutral territory between observers and theorists. We have the cartoons, and they're very helpful because they help us to link these different observational domains. More serious conclusions are, techniques we have for to learn about the structure in the active region before the event are inherently flawed, just observationally. There's noise in the data, and it's messy things about the sampling and ambiguity resolution and things of that sort that make it just inherently flawed at some level. It's going to be much better in the future. This is the main message I have, to make use of more precise methods to really understand the geometry of the field. And these things include imagery, which gives us two, at any point in space, there are like six parameters, right? There's x, y, and z, bx, by, bz. If we had those numbers at every point in the active region, we would know everything about the field. The imagery gives us two projections, right? Quite precisely, it gives us the direction cosines. The radio astronomy gyro resonance surfaces would give us another parameter. That's still three short, and so I'm proposing that in this epoch, when we have these new, better data, we use this mechanical model method over the next few years, matching the eigenfrequencies of forward method modeling so as to get a good idea about the real structure of the active region. And then we can know why it does what it does. Thank you.
The graph, I'm not sure if I completely understood it. The graph you said you didn't quite understand. At the time of a CME, you said which I assume is line of sight flux suddenly does a big increase. Is that what you saw?
No, it's a change. Sometimes it's an increase, sometimes a decrease. And it's as I said, there are 10 or 12 examples. All the X-class flares that Jack Harvey had in Gong observations show systematic change. And the point of it is that it's a displacement. It's not a transient, because during the flare itself, as is well known, there are errors in the magnetographs, and you cannot trust the observations in general. So, but before and after, everything is okay. And so,
it's line of sight.
Well,
so, for instance, in that last one, you suddenly got a lot more flux heading.
That's not the conclusion. It's a change. It could be in one case a line of sight increase, or it could be in another case a line of sight decrease.
But what it's implying in that one you've just seen is you've got a lot more open flux that's basically heading, or at least sticking up, pointing towards you rather than being down.
You mean open? By open, you mean radially outward?
Well, yeah, possibly. Yes.
Okay.
Not necessarily saying you need suddenly more flux there. All you're saying is you're getting changing angle of the field.
Right.
It's more pointing towards you.
Right.
Possibly to do with, well, just the configuration, the fact that you've opened up. And if you're getting
opened up, what do you mean by open? I'm sorry, this is a bad word, I think. You should not use this word. Because it means different things to different people. Open open to a heliospheric physicist means bidirectional electron streaming, or unidirectional electron streaming.
I think it can be explained by the change you see in the geometry of the field.
Right. I think you're right. And the question we have, the challenge you face, is to see if the changes are consistent with your model. There are constraints. One constraint is that the vertical current, this is the Melrose argument, shouldn't change during the event, right? Because the affine speed in the photosphere is so low, and so therefore during the short time scale of the event, that vertical current shouldn't be perturbed.
I'm not worried about currents. I'm just saying a before, after, what is the structure of the field?
Right.
And
right. So one has to have a model for how it changes, and has to match the observations. Is all I'm saying.
David, you have.
Well, it was a sort of different version of the same question. I mean, the way you said that was that the flux was constant, then there was a flare, and the flux changed and was constant again. Why wouldn't you say that there was a change in the flux and there was a flare?
We don't know there's a change in the flux. This is just an imperfect observation of a line-of-sight field in the Harvey case.
Right. I mean, I understand there's a number of ways of interpreting what that change really means, but, I mean, it could be emerging flux, it could be cancelling flux when you get an event. So you've actually changed the flux content of the active region, and that process of changing it creates a flare. I guess I just didn't understand why you tail before the dog in that particular
No. State. If you think the flux change is causing the flare, then you're in the camp of Jim Chin of NRL, who thinks that the CME is caused by injection of poloidal field.
That's a different thing. That's current-driven injection in the structure. I'm saying that. I mean, there's a lot of observational analyses of emerging flux or even cancelling flux prior to an eruption. There's some change that, I mean, so
this is simultaneous.
Understanding what you mean by the flux here.
This is very precisely aligned with the actual brightening of the flare, hard X-ray brightening. The foot points actually match the location quite well. So what we're seeing, I think, and this is just my opinion, is we're seeing the change of the photospheric field signature due to the coronal changes. And it has nothing to do with cancellation or anything of that sort. Whatever's happening up in the corona, let it be reconnection if it wants to be, is changing the photospheric field, and we're seeing that.
Why does the photosphere care? I mean, this is a high plasma beta. I mean, you just made the distinction between these regions.
The field.
It's a brick wall. Why the field can. That you bang your head against?
The field can tilt. Right? There's earlier.
Well, that's Claire's point. I mean, that's not changing the field. It's changing your observation, the component that you're observing.
Yeah.
It's a little bit disingenuous to say there's some physics in there that it's important that this flux is changing. I guess that's what I'm arguing against.
The field is changing.
Geometry of the field.
The field is a vector, right?
I know.
The vector is pointing in a different direction.
Net flux is not changing.
Right. That's what I'm trying to say.
The flux is not changing because it's line tied and the photospheric affine speed is low. The flux, no, but the flux.
I'm just asking for a rewording of the conjecture. Or the
okay.
The observations can't answer that question. You put your own slant on it.
Right.
We don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Mitch?
If you want to model a field starting with the trace observations to give you direction, what do you do about what you don't see? I mean, a lot of the plasmas at the wrong temperatures.
Well, if you had enough of it, I guess my hope is that you can kind of smoothly interpolate and then use the divergence condition to get the rest of it. If you really knew it all the geometry is all you really need with the divergence-free condition.
Well, that helps you along flux tube, but there might be another flux tube nearby that's at the wrong temperature.
Yeah. So I think this is not an automatic thing. You do have to do it in the context of a forward model. You have to have a model there, and it has to have the full three-dimensional structure. And the full thermodynamic structure, too.
More questions? Okay, well, thank you very much, Hugh. So, now if we can get this fixed up, we move on to